Hi, I just wanted to take the time to welcome everyone on the panel today and welcome to the second in All Africa series with African peacebuilders and researchers. My name is Mansadi Sapeka and I'm part of the All Africa webinar team. Our focus today is Nigeria, appropriately nicknamed the Giant of Africa. The West African country boasts a population of over 210 million people and is the largest economy on the continent. But unfortunately, a big population can lead to big problems. Nigeria's people have over the years had to contend with so many challenges: insecurity, conflict, kidnappings, the continuous attacks by extremist group Boko Haram, issues of governance, corruption, and unemployment. But there are those doing what they can to help bring about peace and stability to the country. Among the topics that we would like to touch on in this session include the beginning and background of Boko Haram, and why has conflict been sustained there for so long? Governance, where exactly are the country's leaders falling short, and what role citizens can play to contribute? The economic implications of insecurity, how Nigeria has been responding to security and conflict challenges during the COVID-19 pandemic, and is there involvement of women and youth, or are they excluded from formal and informal peace processes?
I can start with you, Dr. Emeka Njoku.
Hello, everyone. My name is Emeka Njoku. I'm a postdoctoral fellow, an Eton International Fellow of the British Academy and the Royal Society. I'm currently having my tenure at the International Development Department in University of Birmingham here in the UK. For my PhD, I examined the intersections between counterterrorism and civil society organizations. What I was basically looking at was how counterterrorism policies have impacted with and shaped the spaces and actors of civil society organizations in Nigeria. And yes, I've also done some work. I've looked at the various manifestations of counterterrorism policies. I've looked at how it impacts the issue of gender, or how women are impacted differently in the Northeast. And I've also looked at, particularly, I looked at the issue of trauma, what is called vicarious trauma, how women, NGO workers who interact with those victims of sexual violence are themselves affected by the experiences of the victims. So I also look at that issue. And currently, I'm looking at the risking policy. The risking policy is a counterterrorism financing policy that was introduced after 9/11 by the Financial Action Task Force and also domesticated in various parts of the world. I'm looking at how it impacts Muslim communities and how that is changing the relationship between the state and Muslim communities in the UK and Nigeria. I'm doing a comparative study presently. Thank you.
Let's start with Dr. Fatima Akilu now. Doctor, with the work that you do, discuss the challenges you face as a peace builder, specifically on women and marginalization.
Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me. And Emeka, well done for your research, especially highlighting the issue of trauma. I work in conflict, mostly across practically most of the states, apart from two in northern Nigeria. We also work in the Sahel, and we do some work in Syria, and I've recently done some work in Lebanon. A lot of the work that I do is really in mediation, in providing trauma support for victims of violence, insurgency. We also provide rehabilitation, reintegration. A lot of the people who have been kidnapped by terrorists, mostly Boko Haram, who have come out of captivity, we do the reintegration, rehabilitation, reinsertion. We also run an education program where we look at not just access to education, but the content of the curriculum, what is being taught at school. We look at values, we look at character, and we've developed our own values-based curriculum. So we have a school for children of insurgents and children of civilian JTF. And finally, we have a broad-based research platform where we look at pathways into radicalization across the Lake Chad Basin. We also look at women, how they've been affected in and out of conflict and by the conflict. And we also look at issues of banditry and other kinds of conflict, not just insurgency. So once again, thank you for including me on this platform.
You're most welcome. I see Mustafa had joined us. I'm not sure if he can hear me. Mustafa?
Hello.
Hi, hi, Mustafa. Welcome to the panel. I'm Mansadi. We've been communicating by email. We have Juanita from All Africa. And we're just going around with all the panelists, introducing yourselves and the work, the amazing work that you do within Nigeria to help build peace or create peace. If you can just tell us more about yourself and the work you've done.
My name is Mustafa Said. I am a researcher, a sustainable public policy advocate, and youth development enthusiast. I've previously led the Promoting Inclusive Governance and Youth Participation Project in Gombe State under YAGA Africa, that's Youth Initiative for Advocacy, Growth and Advancement, YAGA Africa. At the Center for the Study of the Economies of Africa, my research interest focuses on poverty alleviation, inclusive growth, and governance thematic areas. I am also a member of the World Economic Forum's Global Shapers Community, which is the youth and civil society wing of the forum. And what we do is to engage in social impact that cuts across the development areas, such as, of course, peace and conflict resolution, governance, and everything that has to do with social impact. I was recently appointed as member of the National Development Planning Committee in Nigeria. Essentially, that's what I do. I'm currently working on data governance in the African Continental Free Trade Agreement with CC.
Thank you so much, Mustafa. We want to touch on various topics because Nigeria is very big and there's a lot going on at the moment there and has been going on for some time. But also, just to touch on governance issues, you know, the economic implications of insecurity, the beginning and possible background of Boko Haram, where do they originate from? How Nigeria has been responding to security and conflict challenges, especially during this COVID-19 pandemic that's going to stay with us for some time. And also the question of whether there's involvement of women and youth, or are they excluded from peace processes and informal and formal peace processes? So I'd like to start with Dr. Fatima, just to find out your challenges, Doctor, that you face as a peace builder, specifically dealing with the issue of women and marginalization.
Thank you so much. And just to get us going, I'll give a brief intro into the origins and history of Boko Haram, and then my role as a woman peace builder, if that's all right. Most of us know here, since most of us are researchers, so one kind or the other, Boko Haram started formally around 2002. And at the time, it was a very small group led by Muhammad Yusuf, who was a local preacher in the northeast of Nigeria in Borno State. The group started to grow. He was a very charismatic kind of preacher. And there were a lot of young men, predominantly, who were disillusioned with governance. So it comes to your question about governance, where they were graduating from universities and there were no jobs available to them, no socioeconomic prospects. And they found his teaching very compelling and joined in droves. Muhammad Yusuf then had, his group had a confrontation with the police, and it set them on a collision course with authority. And it eventually led to his capture. He was jailed and extrajudicially killed. They went into hiding, but they really were not hiding. What they were doing was they were regrouping, they were training, they were getting contact with international terror groups, in particular Al-Qaeda at that time, and really planning for a full-scale attack under their new leader, Abubakar Shekau, which they returned to Nigeria around 2010 and launched a full-scale attack. Since then, Boko Haram has morphed into an international group due to affiliation with Islamic State. They broke up into two groups. One led by Abubakar Sheikhou, another led by the son of Muhammad Yusuf, who they became ISWAP. They became part of ISIS's territorial expansion within Africa. So they were the West African affiliate of Islamic State, quickly moved into operating in Chad, Niger, Burkina Faso, and Nigeria. And more recently, we've seen Boko Haram activity as far away as Mozambique in alignment with Islamic State. We've seen them cooperate with different branches of Al-Qaeda, including AQIM. So it's become much more international. And within Nigeria, it has expanded into the Northwest. This was not a region that they had operated in, to our knowledge, at least not in the past 10 years, but they now seem to have a foothold in the Northwest and also Middle Belt. As we know, only in the past couple of weeks, they went into Niger State, which is in the Middle Belt of Nigeria, and they took over three local governments and hoisted their flags. And these are places, obviously, where there has been a lack of government presence. They have now commenced the art of governing, providing resources, organizing people, and really putting down their own laws. That is the origin of the Boko Haram conflict. But Nigeria, as you know, we're battling far more than the Boko Haram conflict. It has expanded beyond terrorism, because what we're seeing is banditry a lot in the Northwest, farmer herder conflicts. But what is more worrying is that all these groups are talking to each other. There have been reports where Boko Haram has outsourced some of its schools kidnapping to bandits, where they paid them to go into schools and kidnap. So this alignment with criminal elements is creating immense instability nationally. I don't know if we're just focusing on Northern Nigeria, but if you see what's going on in the southeast of Nigeria, it's not pleasant at the moment. There has been a lot of criminality, different groups forming, asking for the right to self-determination. The INEC, which is our electoral commission, they've had almost 21 offices that have been burnt only in the past few months in the southeast. 2 days ago, we had one of the foremost politicians, a leading member of the ruling All Progressive Congress, the sitting government, was assassinated in the southeast as he was making his way to the airport. So there is this expansion of conflict across the country. Terrorists do not have the monopoly, but the most worrying for me is that they are cooperating, collaborating, exchanging weapons, resources with all sorts of groups. What that portends, I will leave to the other speakers to speak on. So just very briefly, my role as a woman peace builder, as you know, it's not that easy to stand up and in a country where it's still very patriarchal. There are not many platforms or spaces for women. Often our voices are not heard, we're marginalized, we're ignored, and we're not accorded the respect that we deserve, considering the input that we make. So a lot of peace-building spaces are totally dominated by men. In national peace-building processes that are convened usually by the government have very little input and space for women to be heard. So conflict disproportionately affects women and children. Yet the people who are making decisions are all men, and men from a very patriarchal male prism. How do I navigate that space with a lot of tact? I think as women in this space, we have to work twice as hard as men just to be heard. The area that I focus mostly is on rehabilitation, reintegration, trauma building, trauma support. Now in Nigeria, there are not many people, men or women, full stop, doing a lot of the work that I am doing and have chosen to do. I don't work in spaces where there's a lot of responses already. I work in hard to reach spaces where often we're the only people providing services. And I think because of that, sometimes people do call us to intervene in some of those spaces. But I think as long as we have something like 9 or 6% of women in parliament, we have very few women in the top levels of decision making. Women are not on the big boards in industry, in banking, anywhere where decisions that affect millions of people are made, there is an underrepresentation of women. And as long as that continues, I think even women peace builders like me will continue to suffer marginalization. So in some ways, I think sometimes we work in the shadows. And I'm hoping that as young people grow up, we see women that are in their 20s and coming out of school are really pushing and demanding to be heard, demanding spaces. So I think in a generation, a lot of this will change, because I see there's some softening and weakening of some of the patriarchal structures, even at the same time as we see, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic, more women, more girls being removed from school, a lot of parents marrying off their daughters. So there is this kind of seesaw going on where you see a lot of women that are very highly educated, demanding space, very confident, and breaking these patriarchal structures. At the same time, their counterparts in poorer socioeconomic settings are being denied an education. So I think I'll stop there and let other people comment. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Doctor. You've given us a lot to chew on with regards to your work. I was hoping to bring in Dr. Drenyaran next, if he is still connected or online with us.
Okay. Hello. Okay. Thank you.
Yes. You didn't get a chance earlier to introduce yourself as we were having connection issues. I'd just like you to give us more insight on the research work you've done. If you could speak to, you know, issues of governance and what more the country's leaders can do to help bring about peace within Nigeria.
Okay, thanks everyone, and quite happy to join this discussion. My name is Adedeji Adeniran. I am the director of research focusing on governance and education at the Center for the Study of Economies of Africa. We are based in Abuja. And my core research around governance, just to talk about that, it's on related to tracking progress on SDG 16 in Nigeria and in Africa as a whole. Currently, I think I'm leading the UN regional study on SDG 16. Trying to track, looking at what has been the effect of COVID-19 on peaceful and inclusive institutions in Africa, especially in the Sahel region, and which Nigeria, I mean, what are the kind of triggers for conflict, and what are the kind of process that COVID-19 could generate in the future. So we are leading this global discussion at present, and I urge everybody on this call to also participate in that deliberation, which is trying to harness expert view on the current challenges facing the African continent. But just to look at Nigeria, so one of my research in education focused on issue around inclusiveness and provision of quality education. And one of the issues we've seen that is affecting these objectives in recent time has been the insecurity situation in the northeastern Nigeria that has actually now snowballed into what we see also in northwest and also in the southeastern part of the country. So those are kind of, so what are the triggers? I think we've mentioned Boko Haram and the rest. But I think one of the things I want to mention in terms of the trigger is we should not forget that insecurity begets insecurity. And I think sociologists would describe that as what is called a broken window hypothesis, which in Nigeria, I mean, is more of a shattered window, because in this sense, we've had a lot of insecurity, we have a lot of challenges, but it's not actually well addressed. And the implication is the signal to criminal element among the population that the cost of crime is very low. And so it's a cost-benefit kind of decision-making. If the cost is low, if people commit crimes and we don't have enough infrastructure to nab them, if divisiveness in the fight against insecurity, if it is much, I mean, those are the kind of things that affect lower the cost, and in a way, it's increased crime rate. So the insecurity also in the Sahel region, we don't need to forget that. There is a lot of big ungoverned space in that region, and conflict in weakened states, for example, Chad region, Niger, Libya, those are very weak states and failed states, if you might say. And those kind of challenges snowball into that area. And conflict in that area is very hard to nip down, because this, for security purpose and from even military impact, is a kind of strategic location where you need the conventional war system. We cannot fight it with these terrorists in that region. So it is safe haven sort of for them. And that has enabled them to actually build a kind of structure whereby they could attack Nigerian state, they could mobilize themselves, and they could retreat also as likewise. So those kind of things are one of also the key drivers. But we must not also fail to mention the economic dimension of this conflict. When last year, Nigerian Bureau of Statistics released the new labor market survey, it found 33% of the population unemployed. That's a recipe for disaster. If you look at the figure among even the youth, it's even quite bigger. And if you look at these spaces where we have this conflict, Northeast region, poverty rate in that region is around 80%. In the Northwest region, poverty rate is about 80%. And economic potential and opportunity keeps shrinking for the youth. And the only option, crime since then, like the only option for some youth in that region, or the incentive to take to crime is quite high. So those kind of economic dimension is also part of it.
Sorry to break your word, but you'll have some more time a little bit later to expand on that. We just need to move on to Dr. Njoku and Mustafa Saeed as well.
Dr. Amika, if you could just come in and talk more to the war economy, or what factors outside of Nigeria affect the way Nigeria functions.
All right, thank you very much. I would speak to a recent research that I conducted on, I tied to the Merchants of Terror, New Patrimonialism, Counterterrorism Economy, and the Expansion of Terrorism in Nigeria. I was asking a different question. I was trying to understand that that over the years, since 2014 particularly, we've had an increase in budgets to the defense sector. There's also been an increase in the security vote to particularly countries, states in the Northeast due to Boko Haram and ISWAP terrorism in those regions, particularly the Northeast. And then we would expect at least that these increase and huge amounts of money would translate to meaningful results in curbing the proliferation of terrorism. But what we see is more like a reverse of it. Like, they continue to expand and they continue to, you know, and of course, like Akilu stated earlier, it has become more like there's a link between not just terrorism but bandits. There's a point of convergence of all these groups. And so the question is why? Why is that the military that is known for their efforts in the past
particularly in ECOWAS country through ECOMOG, to curb, help in addressing violence in these countries appear to be very weak or incapable of addressing Boko Haram. And so I try to understand this. That's the motivation for the research. And like I said, there have been huge amounts of money from 2014 to 2019. Budgets to the defense sector grew from 932 billion in 2014 to 1.76 trillion in 2019. And special funds for different security operations, such as Operation Lafayette, Operation Safe Corridor, Operation Gamma Ike, and Operation Crackdown, the funds for those special operations in the Northeast grew from 24.12 billion in 2014 to 75 billion in 2018. And the question is, what has happened to these monies? How have they been used? My key argument is that there is an inherently patrimonial or patron-client relationship between the political actors, public officials, military elites, which has led to the misuse and diversion of security funds through subcontractor practices, ghost and inflated contracts, and on the defense procurement and misappropriation of security votes. Therefore, this has birthed a diabolical, or some would say problematic, counterterrorism economy. And of course, it's also leading to the expansion of terrorism. Basically, what this is saying is that terrorism or violence has become so lucrative that most people are cashing in on it. Basically, that's just more like a simple way to do that. A group of people are, you know, forming different alliances to, you know, benefit from the violence that are going on in the Northeast. And so I don't know if I have much time, I could go into details about these.
You can briefly touch on the deal.
Okay, so yeah, for instance, the defense procurement or contract scam. So like the Ministry of Defense is a government bureaucrats in charge of defense procurement, and the military also plays a certain role in determining the type of and quantity of weapons, hardware that are to be supplied. However, in terms of budgets, because I did more interviews, I interviewed some security agents, top military security agents, and those in foot soldiers involved in counterterrorism. And I was meant to understand that public officials in the defense sector do force contractors on the military. They want the military to work with some people that they have interest with. And so if they don't do that, they will tell them in future, if they come, there is no money. And so they are forced to. So there's a form of collaboration between these parties in order to siphon most money, because they have interest in these contractors. And they bring these contractors, you must work with these people, because so there's no form of mechanism to be able to check, I mean, or due process, even if due process is followed, to what extent is that, you know, followed, you know? And so that's, you know, creates a form of a patron-client relationship that exists between these various actors. And that is a problem leading to what is happening. And on that part is the logistics. Now, the military elites are given the liberty to manage within the operations of violence or the front lines of violence. They are given the liberty for logistics, but how is that being utilized? And we got to find out that most of these funds for logistics are, you know, given to subcontractors, such as relatives, friends, you know, in the supply of basic things like toiletries, food, and things that the soldiers they need. So, but there are no mechanisms to check if, for instance, the amount of money budgeted is in commensurate with what was procured or what was bought, you know, or the quantity of what was provided. This is another means of embezzlement. It might look small, but it's also a means where some group of people are also benefiting from the violence. So once there is no violence and there is no terrorism, there is no means of these crush funds. And so there's all forms of sabotage that goes. Another part is security vote. Like I said earlier, there have been increases in security vote to the violence in the Northeast. So how has that translated to COVID a crisis? Transparency International released a report that approximately 210 billion is allocated to security votes at the state level and 180 billion at the federal level. So it's security votes around 1.51 trillion, equating to 20% of total government spending. This is a figure in 2017, you know, so I don't know that of recent time.
Hi, Mustafa, are you with us there?
I didn't quite catch that.
You your background, experience, and what you explained to us earlier, also your involvement in youth development would be very important here, because there is a whole thing about the youth also taking charge with peace building. So if you could talk more about your experience as a youth development advocate, as well as where you think, in terms of governance, where the leaders are falling short.
Okay, thank you very much. So I think from my experience working with youth groups and young people who are enthusiastic about running for office in Nigeria in 2019, what I've noticed is that although young people have that enthusiasm to run for office, but they lack this capacity to actually create the kind of changes that the country wants. Of course, yes, they might have that patriotism that they want to actually move things around and bring that social change. But I think that capacity to take Nigeria to the promised land is often being lacked among these young people. I think that goes back to where we are as a country in terms of our political leadership. Although these young people have this burning passion to serve the country and bring something new, but often that kind of capacity is often lacked among these young people. And I wouldn't say that this lack of capacity should stop young people from running, because, of course, I mean, looking at the life expectancy in Nigeria and the majority part of the population, we know that they are young. And as such, we really, just like bringing women to the table, we need to bring younger people to the table, because most of the decisions that are going to be made are going to be affecting these young people just as they would be affecting women. And that's why we want to bring these two sets of people to the table, right? It's more like a paradoxical problem, because even the current establishment have that problem. I mean, most times we tend to find out that the people who are in charge are simply just not aware of what they need to do. Maybe there are some certain new trends that are now the order of the day, which they are not necessarily aware of. So what we mostly see is the kind of authoritarian regime that just ban everything, right? And so because they don't have an understanding of the specific things that are involved. And so what they just do is just to ban it, right? That lack of exposure to what needs to be done in order to get things moving. What we need to understand is that government should see bringing about peace as their primary responsibility, but also politicians, political leaders, especially in Nigeria and other emerging democracies, what they should see as their responsibility also is the fact that they should be defenders of democracy. I think that is something that has not been touched on. Most times we have political leaders who don't see defense of democracy as their major responsibility. For instance, in Nigeria, we're supposed to have three tiers of government: the federal government, state, and local government. But like someone just said, I think last week when I was listening to the BBC, he was saying that the local government is in fact not even there. We have about 36 governors who are not showing any commitment whatsoever to ensure that there is democracy in local government. And that is a problem.
Thanks so much, Mustafa. Thank you for that.
If you've just joined us, I'm Anzadi Sepeka from All Africa. You're listening to our All Africa series on peace building. And so far, we've covered the economic implications of insecurity and how Boko Haram have inserted themselves into governance in Nigeria.
Should we, Mansari, take some questions here?
Yes.
If anyone has any questions from the All Africa office, you can either send it on the chat or you can just unmute your mic if you want to ask a question now. I'm going to ask my question to give some people a chance to get their questions in order. I think we've spoken quite a bit about the responsibility of the government, the responsibility of the leadership, and obviously leadership plays a really big role in what is happening in Nigeria, not just Northern Nigeria, but all parts of it. Like Dr. Akilu was saying earlier, you know, just it's spreading all over the country. It's national. There used to be a time when we could say it's northeast Nigeria, and there used to be a time we could say it's happening in the northwest now as well. And now it's just spreading throughout the country. So at the Wilton Park meeting, there was also a lot of talk about should the state be more involved? And I think Mustafa's, telling the state should be more involved. What I'm getting from some of the other speakers and what I got from some of the speakers at Wilton Park was there's two camps. The government should get more involved, or the government's already failed at what it's been doing it's clear that it's not functioning. And earlier there was mention of a failed state. Now, Nigeria hasn't quite gotten to that point where it is called a failed state, but there's definitely conversations around it, particularly after COVID-19. Would it be more government involvement, or is it time for some other body to step up? Maybe we could start with Dr. Akilu and then just move through the rest of the people, whoever wants to comment.
Thank you. Sorry, there was a weakness. What was the last thing that you asked? I'm so sorry. I couldn't hear properly.
Oh, I was saying that there seems to be two camps. The people who believe that, the peace builders who believe that the government should get more involved and that they should, as Mustafa said, you know, they have a, it is what they are supposed to do. They are supposed to promote democracy. They are supposed to enact democracy in the country. And then there's people that say, well, now it's a chance for something else. We can't rely on the government. It's clear that the government's not played the role it's supposed to. And expecting them to win the future is possibly asking too much, because there's so much of involvement in, as Dr. Njoku said, the system, and having those kind of relationships where corruption becomes quite, well, part of the system. Now, where do we go from here?
Thank you for that question. It's so important. Where indeed do we go from here? I think my own take is that we cannot work in silos. The truth is we all need each other. We cannot go forward without government. That's the reality, because we have to have a system where we organize ourselves. If it's not the current form of government, then what should be the type of government we want? We often look at government as this monolithic entity, but what about our roles either within government or outside of government as citizens? People go into government very often not to serve. They go into government as a form of enriching themselves or as a means to acquire power. So unless we change what we want and we expect from our government, government is made up of representatives of the citizens. It's not some other. It is us. And we must, first of all, recognize that. Every 4 years, we have a chance to change government. It hasn't been so successful in Nigeria because we have changed government, but we found the same kinds of mindsets. So what we need to really look at is leadership. What kind of leaders do we want? What is the role of character? What is the role of empathy? What is the responsibility of the state to its citizens? And on the other hand, even in civil society, I think, what can we do? Can we do more? I think absolutely. In Nigeria, we don't hold the National Assembly to account to the level that they should. They have a lot of powers to enforce laws that make us, even the executive, to govern better. But often they don't do that. And we, the citizens, civil society, we don't hold them to account. So I think the way forward, if we are to really play a part in building a more hopeful nation, is that we must all stand up and realize that government is not them, it is us. And a lot of people who can make a difference do not join government. I know the road is hard, but we sit back in the sidelines and we play quarterback from our armchairs. So we must stand up and be counted. To answer your question, I think that we need both the civil society, we need government, we need all citizens to be accountable and to stand up and decide what kind of governance we want, what kind of way forward.
So Esther from All Africa is asking if there's any way that the international community can step in if Nigeria asks for help. I pose this question to any of you on the panel who can respond to that.
I've been asked this question before. What can the international community do? There is a doctrine known as the responsibility to protect. It's a principle that was established by the United Nations in 2005. The responsibility to protect doctrine is a global political commitment which was endorsed by all member states and which aims at ensuring that the international community never again fails to halt mass atrocities of genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. So, but if you look at what is happening in Nigeria today, we've seen that many of these things that I've listed out, you know,
at least some of them fall within the definitions of genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, crimes against humanity. A lot of people are being killed, not just by Boko Haram or terrorist group, but by various people who claim to call themselves bandits and, you know, all kinds of, and of course, the farmer herdsmen crisis. Crises that have taken different dimensions, including ethnic. And so, yeah, what an international community do, it's already there. What they can do is already within the international legal instrument. So, but having the something on paper and having the will to do so is a different kettle of fish. And so, yeah, the international community should start taking seriously the R2P or the responsibility to protect and be able to act. Because again, terrorism is not local, it's not just local to Nigeria. Like we have seen how they have managed to spread in different parts of West Africa, and now we have in East Africa. Of course, they have been in East Africa, and we have in Central Africa. So you see how they spread. It's not just a one country problem, it's a global challenge. And we need global efforts to be able to address these forms of violence. And like I said earlier, there's a point of convergence, banditry, former headsmen or whatever, and the ways they communicate, like Fatilu Akinu said earlier. So there's a need for the international community to come in under the doctrine of responsibility to protect, to help countries, not just in training. Most of the programs they have is just to train military officers. I mean, at this point, I don't think training alone can be able to help. They need to, you know, to come and be under that principle, or you need to implement that principle, because the Rwandan genocide started like this. I mean, like what we are seeing. So we can't allow the country to generate to that particular stage of violence. And so yes, they can do that. And in terms of Corbyn, how people have used or using terrorism as a means to advance themselves economically, there are laws already that could address all these issues that could be amended to incorporate those who are guilty or who are guilty of this particular act or actions, and they should be prosecuted. For instance, the whole support of terrorism, people who make money or who advance their career or their finances using funds that are supposed to be used to curb terrorism, I mean, are inadvertently in their actions leading to the expansion and sustenance of terrorism. And so they should be classified under that particular category of those who support terrorism and should be prosecuted if they are found guilty. And I think at the stage which we are presently, it requires just more than citizens trying to be good to themselves, because there are a lot of good people out there, but that alone, the leaders, I mean, Chief Achebe said that Nigeria is a people that have lost the habit of building themselves. So we have leaders who are anything but citizens or leaders. The word leadership shouldn't be ascribed to the type of people that we have now. So yes, so
Dr. Njoku. That was very, very enlightening. I want to ask this question. It's directed at Mustafa.
Yeah.
If that's okay. And then if you could ask over Esther's final question to the panel. So Mustafa, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. So
But I couldn't hear him clearly.
Okay, so there's a question directed for you. It asks, what is the connection between education and terrorism? Because from what I see, education is not really being promoted in northern Nigeria, just as in northern Cameroon, where Boko Haram is also operating.
I think there is an absolute connection between education and terrorism, or lack of. I have been advocating that the short-term remedy to insecurity in Nigeria might be the military approach, as we've been seeing it. But in the long term, what we need to do is probably to make sure that more people are in school, or like everyone is in school. The younger people that are coming up, we should make sure that they're all in school. And not just that they're in school, but we should also make sure that what they're teaching them is actually something that would make them peacemakers. Because right now we have a curriculum that has not been updated. And so we have these modern realities that our education does not prepare people to tackle. And when I talk about these realities, it's not just industry work realities, because I mean, Nigeria is a project, right? We are in a nation building project, because right now we all know, without any index, we know that the country is divided, and what we need to do is to make peace with each other. So what do you do in order to achieve that? I think that involves a deliberate effort spread across a period of time, teaching people about what they need to do, and not just teaching different tribes to live in peace, but also we need to start taking into consideration things like mental health, which is very important. You know, just last week, some students in a university in Nigeria were suspended because of something they did. They were ridiculing a young woman who came out in a dressing that was hitherto considered as one of the pious. Even those people who want to determine what women should wear thought that is something that was acceptable. But just because of some unfounded belief that these girls could have gotten it by doing something, they thought they could just shame any woman that came out in that kind of clothing. So I think I was so shocked because these were students of a university, for God's sake, that were doing this, right? And so I think in the future, we know clearly that this education that we are investing so much in, because most of universities in Nigeria are publicly funded, right? And so we can't be funding these universities only for them to be producing like people who have this kind of mindset, right? Because for us to make peace, it's not just about living in peace with tribes, but also respecting each other, respecting genders, respecting views, respecting everyone.
Thank you, Mustafa. And Adedeji, if you could... Adedeji, if you could come in and just make
about
that second part of that question, because not only is Boko Haram operating in Nigeria, but it has moved to different parts of Africa, specifically Northern Cameroon, where Michael is from, that asked the question. So if you could speak to that, because I think that's also important, that it's no longer a Nigerian problem, but it's a regional issue as well.
So it's no longer, I mean, like you said, it's no longer a Nigerian problem, it's a regional issue. But the problem is, if we are going to solve this problem, it requires global action. And I think I like that question that someone asked about what can people do for us. And I want to add two things that they can also do for us. One is the issue of small proliferation of arms, especially arms getting to non-state actors, is one of the key drivers in that region. So how do we control that space is crucial. And it's only if you look at value chain of illegal arms, it's not coming from Africa. It's coming from the US, it's coming from the from the Europeans and the rest. So how do we ensure that weapons do not get to non-state actors? It's very crucial. And there are a lot of international protocol on that, but international bodies and in the private sector in most of these countries are not adhering to it. So we need to find a way around that. But crucially, I also think the ungoverned spaces in these regions, and those are too many in Nigeria. I mean, a lot of informal sector, very large and everything. These ungoverned spaces, I think we need to have like a policy. How do we bring government to everyone in terms of everybody have a sense of belonging? Because if you look at the way we are solving this problem, and this is a tragedy, there is even not a kind of unifying approach. You look at what government at the local level wants in terms of the solution is not what the federal government wanted. So those kind of disconnect, you can't fight actually this kind of crisis with this disconnect. So we need to work together. But I also want to say Nigerian government and Nigerian people too, they need to call for help when they need it. I mean, in some instances, one of the very success we've recorded in this Boko Haram issue has been when the previous administration invited some machinery, I think from South Africa, in order to support with their technical capacity in that fight. I mean, if our military are not adequate enough, if the kind of warfare we are facing is unprecedented, and we don't have experience in that regard, so we don't have, I think we should also call for help. So it's about the global other countries helping us. Also, we also being actually honest enough to request for assistance when we need it. And I think at this moment, Nigeria needs this kind of support. I must admit it, because I mean, we lack capacity and we are not solving this problem. It's actually increasing. And if care is not taken, it's going to consume this country. So we just need all the help we could get.
Mansa, do you want to look at some of the other questions and ask those? Is anybody, unless anyone wants to speak to what Adedeji just said?
Well, I'll move on to the next question. It's specifically for Dr. Ekulu. The question says, African Union Special Envoy Benita Diop said last year that we cannot silence the guns in Africa without the inclusion of women in peace processes. What could be done to bring greater participation of women in conflict resolution?
Thank you for the question. I think it's important that, first of all, we pay attention to the fact that there are not that many women represented at the decision-making tables. And maybe what we could do is some kind of proportional representation that in every, whenever there's a peace process or peace talks, that a certain percentage of women included. Because I think without a concerted effort, we'll continue to leave women out of the peace process. So I think that would be my answer. That we just need to be more aware and have dedicated numbers and spaces for women. Because we found that when women have been part of the peace process, we've seen it in Tunisia, we've seen it in Afghanistan, we've seen it in Pakistan, that the talks have been much more inclusive, they have been much more constructive, and they have really been wider in terms of taking into account the specific needs of women and girls that sometimes get missed out when we talk about peace.
Thank you so much, Dr. Akilu. There is another question. There has been talk of politicians being behind Boko Haram, in particular to undermine the Buhari administration. Has there been inquiry into this type of allegations? Before we answer that, Dr. Njoku, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to add to what, Dr. Akilu. I'm sorry, I was calling the wrong. I wanted to add to that. I mean, look at the coronavirus challenge we had, and look at the countries where it was properly managed. They were women presidents or prime ministers. So, I mean, we are seeing empirical evidence that women can do better job. We also have very, very good women administrators in Nigeria, but they are not given any space to operate. They are not. I would want a female president for Nigeria because I think they will do a better job. The point is that, you know, based on our structural or patriarchal nature of the Nigerian society, women are just pushed aside and always pushed aside at various level of political leadership. And so that's a problem. That's a problem that we need to start thinking about, because women have shown the capacity to manage countries, the capacity to manage institutions or organizations far, far better. I mean, so yeah, I am strongly in support of incorporating women, not just in peace building, but in every form of leadership.
I mean, I think calling it a big problem is probably an understatement, particularly because it's a societal issue. Behavior change always takes a little bit longer. So yeah, I think behavioral changes is where we're getting stuck. Thanks, Dr. Njoku. Back to Esther's question, is one of conspiracy, which is people have been trying to find out why Boko Haram has been so successful in undermining the Buhari administration, but also in undermining so many administrations before Buhari. This argument comes up quite often. It comes up that there are politicians behind Boko Haram that are targeting the Buhari administration. What kind of merit does that argument have? We can start with you, seeing as your mic is open, Dr. Njoku.
Oh, okay. I don't know if there are politicians who are Boko Haram members or who are supporting Boko Haram and trying to undermine the... I can't speak to that because I don't have any empirical evidence to that effect. But during Goodluck Jonathan's administration, he did mention that his administration has been infiltrated by Boko Haram. I mean, that's the president, I mean, the former president was president at the time, and he made such allegation and would believe that the president has the machinery to get information. And so for him to make such statements, I mean, it's something that is troubling, and it's something that we should, you know, make concerted effort to understand. But I wouldn't know if there are members of Boko Haram, Boko Haram people behind, but I do know that people are profiting in some way from it. And that is in itself a problem. That is in itself a problem that also contributes in the sustenance and the expansion of terrorism. So yeah, so I think it's more of people profiting from it, like people taking advantage of violence. So violence is more like a lucrative business. I mean, at various levels, people who are making money from increase in budgetary allocation, people who are profiting from the sale of weapons, you know, sale of weapons both locally and internationally, and people who feel that the only way that the government can get them to listen to them is through violence. So you see how these interconnections of various actors, you know, how they, you know, these come together, but ultimately makes the state very, very uncomfortable for, and I mean, leading to all kinds of killings and destruction. There is really no empirical evidence to say, oh, Boko Haram, but politicians can use violence to assert their, I mean, research has shown that politicians can use violence to reassert themselves or for political ascendancy or to be relevant in three cases of web of corruption.
Thank you very much, Dr. Njoku. Thank you for that. It really is true what you say. I mean, there is no empirical evidence. You will never know how much influence Boko Haram has. Are there any last comments from anybody else on the panel with regards to our discussion today? So if any of the other panelists would like to have a last comment?
Particularly my arguments from the very beginning about the merchants of terror. I'm saying that I would conclude that the lack of inherent lack of fiscal responsibility and mechanism to check for transparency and accountability in the utilization of security funds expose the government's complicity in the failure to defeat Boko Haram, because there's a crucial need to address the pathology of funding terrorism in Nigeria, and by extension, other parts of the Chad region, by dismantling the structures of new patrimonial logic that have led to a diabolic counterterrorism economy and the expansion of terrorism. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Njoku. Asked Dr. Dedije to come in.
So thanks. What will be my last comment is just to emphasize on the importance of that this in as much as the conversation is about government, there is need for community support. Because in the fight on terrorism, what is the most important weapon is intelligence. And if people on the ground are what we refer to as intelligent. So if they are not supportive of government action, if government action is not in any way inclusive or trying not to bring them into the conversation, that kind of valuable intelligence is not going to be honest, and we would not be able to effectively pursue the fight. So how do we encourage more community participation is very crucial, and it's about bringing them in terms of what do they need to support and gaining their confidence in that fight. So both military option is good, but community kind of support is the most crucial. Thank you.
I believe Thank Mustafa you, Dr. wanted to go next. Sorry.
Yes.
So yeah, I wanted to come in before the other issue that was raised died down, and that is the issue. I mean, that is the concern that people are raising, that probably the Boko Haram crisis or every other crisis currently developing the country is just a means of undermining the current government. Well, for me, I mean, whether that is true or not, I am putting that as a challenge to the incumbent government. I mean, your ability to be a government that we can trust depends on your ability to thrive in spite of everyone that wants to put down your government, right? Because I mean, you should be able to, I mean, the attacks that are coming right now are not affecting you directly, they're affecting the citizens, right? So as you are trying to defend yourself against those people you claim are trying to attack your government, you are only helping your citizens. So you should be able to thrive in spite of those people who want to put your government down. That was what I wanted to close with. And then lastly, what I wanted to say is the fact that, I mean, there is an opportunity right now because most young people are online. So what am I saying? From the issue that I raised in the beginning, there is an opportunity for capacity building for young people and every other vulnerable group that are trying to come into the political space, expose them to modern solutions of some of the most intractable challenges of our time, so that should they be able to get opportunity to serve in political positions, they will be able to bring the kind of change that we need in the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Fatima, you'd be the last one to make a comment.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think I'd like to end on a note of hope and optimism. I think the fact that, yes, we understand that the problems in Nigeria have increased over the past couple of decades, but we've had problems in the past, including the Civil War, where we have chosen to stay together and united. And I think, we're at a crossroads where we can use this opportunity to really look at our union, what we want, how do we want to live. There has been calls for restructuring, but when people talk about restructuring, they think restructuring means that we want to exercise certain parts of the country and they go on their own, but that's not what restructuring is. It's about how do we consolidate and divide our fiscal resources, how do we empower our regions, arguments about whether the regions we have are too many and how can we consolidate. And so as we go through these discussions, we need to have more inclusive roles and spaces for women, for youth, and really chart a path for how a post-conflict nation can look like. And my belief is that it can be better and it can be stronger. So I'd like to end on that note.
Thank you for that, for those positive words amidst all the conflict that is going on. I just wanted to also take this time to thank all of you for joining us, for taking the time to take us through your research, the work you do, behind the scenes that we never really know about until we actually find you and realize that there's a lot of work going on the ground to create peace or to bring about peace within a very much troubled country with regards to conflict and lack of governance and the like. So just thank you so much for your time, everybody. We do have another session that's happening again sometime. We're going to be discussing Ethiopia. But for now, we thank you for your time, and we hope you continue with your amazing work on research and peace building within Nigeria and West Africa. Of course, all Africa is also very grateful. Without the Carnegie Corporation of New York, we would not be able to have these sessions, so we're grateful to them for supporting our reporting on peace building in Africa. So thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.